You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful sunny Davis day. And I get to say that even though it rained a little bit before, but Don, our high is going to be in the 60s next week.
That's what it looks like. We are going rapidly into fall here in a pattern, by the way, talking with old timers in the area, like myself. This is one of the fastest moves into the feeling of fall that any of us can remember. Normally, we have long period in September and October where it feels very much more like summer. We'll have a north wind. It'll be close to 90. It was, in fact, close to 90 a couple days ago. We do have periods of dry wind when the humidity is as little as 15 to 20%. Not much of that has happened. We've just been steadily getting shorter days, cooler nights, and we have hit 50 degrees at night twice now. And we're going to see a little bit more of that with a rapid decline in daytime highs as well. Lois and I are preparing this show October 8 for broadcast on October 9, 2025. Temperature right now at University Airport is 64 degrees, going up to a high today of 79 degrees and sunny. But we do have some increasing clouds on the horizon. And in fact, by the time the show airs on Thursday, it'll be mostly sunny, 73 degrees, mostly clear Thursday night, 51, but a slight chance of showers on Friday, 20% chance of showers, 72 degrees. And Friday night will be 50 degrees, slight chance of showers and then clearing up. Saturday, 72 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, 50 degrees and clear. Sunday, 73 degrees and sunny. Sunday night, partly cloudy, low around 52. Columbus Day, Monday, a chance of showers, partly sunny with a high near 65. That's right. Our high is going to be below 70 Monday night and Monday night. And then Tuesday, a chance of showers, and it's only going to be 67 degrees. So rapidly heading into fall feeling, fall weather, a little bit of rain may be happening, but not enough to do much more than move the dust around, as we like to say. One thing I like to do to assess the future weather issues and gardening is note what the farmers are doing as I drive in the morning. And a few days ago, before that storm was coming in, I passed not one, but two helicopters loading up with pesticides to do some crop dusting on the way in, probably fungicides. I saw farmers out disking their fields and furrowing them, getting ready to just absorb the rainfall if and when it comes in, probably doing some planting. I couldn't tell if they were direct seeding or not, but a lot of them would be seeding wheat and other things at this time of year. And really what I noticed was the remaining tomato growers who still have fields that weren't harvested were scrambling to get them harvested. And pretty much all the tomato fields are done at this point as I drive in and drive back on the county roads. As of about 3 days ago, the very last field near us was harvested, the great big 20-ton tomato trucks driving away. We are rapidly going into fall planting mode. Lots of questions about vegetables, flowers, cover crops, seeding lawns, scattering wildflower seed, planting trees, planting shrubs. It's that time of year. The most active time in the garden, other than spring, here in the Sacramento Valley, East Bay, interior Southern California, and of course, all up and down the coastal zones, is really the period mid-October to late November. The soil is still warm. It is dry, so you need to irrigate for any of these things we're talking about, but the temperatures are getting to that very moderate in-between stage where things will root in quickly, might put on a little top growth, but most especially make some root growth a great time for planting. Folks are going to native plant sales. The Arboretum has had one of their sales. They've got more coming up. And nurseries, of course, are stocking in like crazy with perennials and shrubs and trees and natives and things like that. So it's a great time to do those big garden projects with the temperature getting to where people want it to be. I do want to quickly review our rainfall year since the rainfall season is October 1 through September 30. And in Davis, the official 2024-2025 rainfall year ended up with 14.7 inches of total precipitation, which is about 3 to 4 inches lower than average. So it was a relatively dry year. What it really was a dry spring. We had, let's see, November, we had 4 inches. December, we had 3.5 inches. January, we had less than a half an inch. It was a dry January. But in February, we had 5.6 inches, which is well above average for February. March, 1 inch of rain. April, 14/100ths of an inch, and nothing basically from that point forward. So our last significant rainfall was actually in March. And we went into the planting season with the soil surprisingly dry. We kept mentioning that over and over during the garden show during the summer because people were starting the year with dry soil and didn't get it adequately hydrated in many cases. That was probably the reason for many people just not getting great results with their vegetable garden. They didn't have enough soil depth of enough moisture down where the roots were going to try and grow, and they weren't watering deeply enough. And so a lot of things like tomatoes just didn't perform as well. We also had a very cool July, which had some impact, but rainfall pretty much ended in early April. And beyond that, we had nothing as usual. June, July, August, September, zero rainfall, and nothing so far really to speak of in October, except a little bit that just moistened the surface and got a few weeds to germinate. If you're going to plant things now, you need to water. Many people are asking me, should I turn off my system? No, the soil is very dry. You can probably cut back on the frequency. You certainly don't need to be watering your lawn every other day right now. You certainly probably don't need to be watering anything every other day right now. But the soil is dry around where you're planting. You need to water the plant itself. You need to water the soil around it. And we continue that until we've had 1 to 2 inches of rain. Then we know that the soil has been hydrated to a depth of a foot or so, and at least the shallower roots of newly planted plants are getting what they need. We still have to keep an eye on it through the winter, but it's rare for us to need to irrigate at all mid-November through mid-March. You might find a dry spell in which you choose to irrigate newly planted plants. We've had years where January is very dry, like this year. So a little hand watering might be necessary. That's an as needed basis. You certainly don't need your system to be running through the winter. So mid-November is usually the point where we change over, but we do have to use some judgment on that.
One of the things to judge is your trees, because Don just said that in the first couple of storms we'll have, oh, is this 18 inches, 12, 18 inches deep? Well, my tree roots are a little bit deeper than
Yes,
that.
indeed.
So I should probably make sure that my tree roots continue to get watered until we get enough rain to actually soak all the way down in there.
Yeah, I have drip lines on my whole farm, and many of the plants that are well established get a roughly once a month, very thorough soaking, literally running the drip line all day or overnight. In fact, it's running as we're recording this show. I'll probably do my last one of those really deep irrigations now in the middle, early to mid-October. But if we don't get rainfall going into November, in some cases, I may use some judgment, go ahead and do another cycle of irrigation. The ET rate is dropping rapidly. The days are getting shorter. There are actually cloudy days happening every now and then. So the water use by plants is diminishing, but the soil is very dry. An inch of water in general will penetrate about a foot in most of the soils in this region and many of the places people are listening elsewhere in California. 1 inch per foot is a good rule of thumb. That's what we often tell you as we're telling you how to irrigate your lawn. An inch of water all at once will go down about a foot, which will cover most of the roots of the grass species. So when we've had 1 to 2 inches of rain, we know we've gotten 1 to 2 foot of penetration in our soils. Obviously, that varies depending on whether you have bedrock or whether you have the actual soil. Some places you're listening, you really don't even have the topsoil to speak of. But in our area, agricultural area, 1 inch of water will generally go down about a foot. So when we've had an inch or two of rain, plants are kind of on their own. Many of them are going dormant completely. Others are in a resting phase, so they don't need as much irrigation. But in the years I've been here, there have been winters where we just didn't get rainfall. We had one January with zero rainfall. And it was interesting that year, I remember watching the walnut growers in the area. They opened up the valves and they gave their walnut orchards a very thorough irrigation in the month of January. And since my neighbor is a walnut grower, I asked him, they're dormant. What's the deal with that? He said, well, I'm trying to get a 2 to 3 foot depth of irrigation because the soil is dry. And in fact, with walnuts in particular, they had found that drought stress midwinter would significantly reduce yield the next summer. That doesn't matter to you with your oak tree, perhaps, but it does tell you that the soil moisture can be a factor in the performance of the tree. We're not looking at a major drought ahead. We're on La Nina watch is the most recent update from National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration with respect to El Nino, La Nina. It's not strong. It's not necessarily happening yet. So we're not looking at a major drought event, but we are starting with a dry year. We're going into this with having had a relatively dry year behind us. And keep an eye on those bigger trees, and especially things that have been planted within the last 2 to 5 years. An extra irrigation in the winter, if we aren't getting rainfall, could be very helpful.
Well, it is time for Patricia Carpenter to invite people over to her place again. She does this periodically, and I'll read your invitation. You are invited to enjoy Patricia's native garden on a typical cool fall day. The garden, a secluded 1 acre wild escape on the slough, is located west of Davis. Started in 2005, it now features about 400 species and cultivars of California native plants. So visit Patricia's garden. And it is November 2nd. It is a drop-in 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. self-guided ramble, and rain or shine, it doesn't matter what it is, and you don't know what it's going to be this year. It could be
Could
anything.
be
So
doing it.
anyway, if you need more information about that, you can go to the California Native Plant Society website and see more. We'll tell you more as we get closer. Well, we have been talking to you for the past year about master gardeners. We mention them quite frequently, and we had told you that the master gardeners had a training program coming up. And so if you wanted to become a master gardener, you could join them. And we get this message from Jennifer, who says, "Thank you for all your support of our Master Gardener program. I wanted you to know that I've probably gotten a few new candidates for the upcoming training class, thanks to you and your efforts."
Well, thank you. Good to hear. And if you want to become a master gardener volunteer, the 2026 volunteer training program application period is now closed. So you can get on a list to receive the application in the summer of 2026 for 2027 training. You can call, get your pencil handy, 707-389-0645 that was 707-389-0645 or you can email a link that you can find at ucanr.edu and just type in the little search box, Yolo County Master Gardener Program.
It's time to plant. It's time to plant trees, shade trees, fruit trees. It's time to plant cool season vegetables. And then low water and pollinator plants, California natives.
This was my attempt at a synopsis of what you can be doing mid-October to mid-November to run in a 3x6 advertisement. I also put, don't forget your winter and spring flowers to plant now, which is actually an important category that we kind of overlook here. Pansies, violas, snapdragon, cyclamen, things like that. But it's a very, very active planting period right now. Everything from woody plants, the trees and the shrubs, perennials, a great time to divide perennials. If you have some that have done well and you want to increase them, great time to add more perennials to your long border you all have, right? Where you have a mix of herbaceous perennials. Vegetables definitely selling like crazy and everybody asking about all kinds of things. I did have my first, isn't it kind of late to plant? Yesterday, first week of
Late
October.
to plant?
Yes. We're happy to say, nope, it's not too late to plant most things. It is too late for Brussels sprouts and rutabagas, but you can plant broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, carrots, collards, kale, lettuce, spinach, peas, and much more. Those all can go in right now. This is a great time to plant them, mostly from transplants, although some of them could be done directly from seed. Peas, for example, are probably simple as just a direct seed, although we have seedlings of them. Look, we actually sell seedling carrots.
What?
Yeah, I know. That's what I said when I first saw them on availability list 10 years ago. And then the grower said, no, put them out there. People will buy them. I said, well, they'll buy them. How will they do? That's my question. So I brought them in. And as I like to do for you all, I took some home and I planted them and I didn't even divide them. Six packs of carrot seedlings with two to three seedlings in each cell pack. I thought, all right, I'm just going to do this as if I were one of my customers. And I planted them out and they grew great and they grew through the allotted span. And I went to harvest them and they were perfectly good carrots, all intertwined with each other, but they were great. They were fine. It did work. So for those of you that are looking at six packs of carrots and going, as Lois said, what? Yes, indeed, it does work. And why would someone do carrots from six packs? Well, part of it is that the seed takes as much as a month to germinate. So that's the first issue right there, that germination of carrots is very slow. We do recommend pre-soaking it. That'll speed it up to, let's say, 3 weeks to germinate. Well, it's October, 3 weeks means they're not even coming up until early November. So yes, you do get a bit of a head start by planting carrots from six packs. I haven't yet managed to bring myself to bring in the six packs of radishes that one of my growers
Oh,
has.
come now.
There are people who won't plant anything from seed. So if they want to have radishes, they're going to buy a six pack of radishes and they're going to plant them out. And that's the way they're going to have radishes. So for, is that a good use of your $7? I don't know. But in my opinion, root vegetables are best to direct seeded, but some may find that there are reasons that they want to transplant them. All those other things we went through are great from transplants: broccoli, cauliflower, collards, all of those things, the brassicas and the lettuces, leaf lettuces, and spinach and arugula and fennel, and all those kinds of things are in nurseries right now. Radicchio, and many kinds of kale. This is a great time to plant kale. All of those are fairly easy from seed. But that's all 3 to 4 weeks back in terms of getting started on that. So a lot of people do want to do them from six packs, and it makes sense.
Okay, we have a mailbag question here. And Pat writes to us, I had a question about watering my plants. We have a Sally Holmes rose, newly planted, that I water once a week, and a Meyer lemon tree, purchased last month or so, that I water twice a week. Now that it's fall, do I continue watering on this schedule, or do I stop watering in November, or when the plants go dormant, etc.? Now, these appear to be plants in the ground, not in a pot.
Yeah, very important concern question. So if it was in a planter box filled with soil that you purchased from a rock yard, we'd be having a different conversation. In fact, we just had that conversation with someone over the last few days. It's drying out so quickly. Yeah, the stuff you buy and fill planter boxes with is essentially potting soil and is a different management strategy. I am finding myself the things that I've planted over the summer, once a week watering is just fine now. It's cooled off enough. We've had some days with cloud cover. The soil isn't drying out as quickly as it was. So if you can shift over to once a week thorough soaking until we get an inch or so of rain, that would be great.
All right, here's another message that we've gotten, and this is from Tanya in Davis. I am stumped and need your help. 3 to 4 years ago, I bought a flame Tokay grape from the Fair Oaks Horticultural Center. Last year, I got a couple of little grape bunches, but I waited and waited and waited, and they never turned green. From the nurture, let me start that entire thing over.
There you go.
Five.
Four, three.
Shh. All right, we have a question here from the mailbag, and this is from Tanya in Davis. I am stumped and need your help. 3 to 4 years ago, I bought a flame Tokay grape from the Fair Oaks Horticultural Center. Last year, I got a couple of little grape bunches, but I waited and waited, and they never turned from green to the pretty reddish color of a flame Tokay. This year, I got giant bunches in August and September, but they were again all green and never turned flame Tokay color. They were also seedless, so I figured that I got a mislabeled grape since flame Tokay grapes have seeds. And these green grapes tasted terrible, so I wasn't sure what the problem was. Fast forward to this weekend. I decided I was going to take out that grape since it wasn't the kind I wanted. But then I see the remnants of a small bunch of grapes that was hidden. And guess what? This little remaining grape bunch totally looked like a flame Tokay. It was the right color. It even had seeds. It tasted just like a flame Tokay should taste. This one grape was wonderful. All the bunch had been eaten by backyard critters. So, Any idea what might have happened? I am enclosing photos of the inedible seedless green grapes I initially harvested this month, as well as photos of the grape plant itself. Could it be rootstock that took over? How could I get two types of grapes on one plant? Perhaps that one beautiful flame tokay grape was merely a dream. Thank you for helping me to figure out this mystery. I am totally stumped.
Well, it's extremely helpful. First of all, I like to congratulate a gardener who has 3 to 4 years into a plant and it produces fruit that's inedible and doesn't give up, because that just tells you what we're like as gardeners. We just keep trying. And flame tokay is a wonderful tasting grape. It does have seeds, so you're not going to find that at a lot of garden centers. We have found as retailers, nobody wants seedy grapes, but many of them have really, really rich flavor. I'm very glad you sent pictures of the grapevine itself, particularly since I would have had to ask you to do this otherwise. Down at the ground level, it very much appears that this is grafted. Now, I sell grapevines at my nursery, and they're not grafted. The grapevines that I grow and sell usually are just rooted cuttings, because grapes will root from cuttings. And for the home garden market, there isn't generally a need to worry about rootstocks. The rootstocks that are used for grapes are commercial. They're used for vineyards and such. Generally, they're being developed for resistance to phylloxera or other root louse or root aphid, or to disease problems that have been, major problems in the wine grape industry. Many, many, many years ago, in the 1950s and early 60s, all the grapevines in Napa and Sonoma County were on a particular rootstock that was phylloxera tolerant or resistant. And then as time went by, that tolerance and resistance went away. And I remember 10 or 20 years ago, in other words, the pest overcame it. 10, 20 years ago, a whole lot of vineyards were being ripped out, burned, and they were replanting with new grapes on new rootstocks. And so people would ask me about grape rootstocks. So what rootstock are your grapes on? I said, they're not on any rootstock. As a home gardener, you don't have phylloxera. It's almost a certainty. You're not growing a vineyard. It doesn't really matter. But there are some growers out there that do sell grafted grapes. I've occasionally gotten grafted grapes in. I don't know that much about the rootstocks, except that there's a bunch of different kinds. I mean, a lot of different kinds. And these are hybrids that are selected for vigor and disease resistance or pest tolerance. And without regard to whether the fruit is going to be present at all or of any, desirable flavor, because you don't generally allow the rootstock to grow. Nobody cares about the flavor or quality of the grape that is produced by a rootstock, except in this instance where it appears that a significant portion of your plant has been overtaken by the rootstock, whatever it is. So now you get to go and find the traces of that flame tokay grape that is still there, that one branch that is what you actually planted, and prune out everything else. And it will be most of your grapevine from the looks of it. You will lose most of what has grown because that's mostly rootstock. But that means you'll get back to your basics and you'll have a really strong root system for the one branch of flame tokay that's still present. And it should take off next spring once you have removed all of the competition from the much more vigorous rootstock. And hopefully your plant will grow vigorously. Might not produce next year, might put more of its energy into growth than fruiting, but you should be back on track. But people do need to be aware that most people know this with fruit trees in general. They at least understand in principle that they're two different plants. At the top is one thing, your Alberta peach, and the root system is something else. It's with the rootstock. They can see the graft union. It's very clear on most fruit trees, but on grapes, it's not that clear. There's not a distinct phase change. I see what appears to be that phase change on your plant. So it looks like I can tell pretty carefully where the rootstock has come up, and you should be able to figure that out yourself. In a lot of cases, trees are grafted. People know that. In the few cases in garden centers, they're not. Figs are almost never grafted. Grapes are sometimes, but usually not. And so some fruit things that you buy are on their own roots, and you don't have to worry about this. Pomegranates are not grafted. But if you do get rootstock on any desirable fruit species, whether a vine or a tree, in some cases it's very vigorous. In many cases, it will outgrow the top, the thing you planted. Citrus, that can be a huge problem. And they need to be removed as soon as you figure it out, or else you get to this situation a couple of years later where the rootstock is the dominant plant. I looked at a grapefruit once where it was a 12-foot grapefruit tree that hadn't fruited, just never fr well, it had a couple fruit, Don, but they were here and they were okay, but the rest of it's grown like crazy. And finally, you put out this fruit and it's totally inedible. What happened? That's rootstock. And in that case, it was well over three quarters of the tree. I said, your choice now, prune out all the rootstock and have something about the size of what you planted several years ago and start over, or, cut your losses, dig it out, and plant a new tree entirely. You'll have to make that judgment as to whether you can find the branch of Tokay, flame Tokay, and prune everything else out, which would be a bit of a challenge. Get that all out of there and monitor carefully next spring to make sure nothing comes up from below the graft and takes over again. And then you're back to where you were, or you can just buy yourself a new one. That's either way will work, but it does appear it got overtaken by rootstock.
Oh, Don, I love this one. This is from Tara in Oakland. I am writing in hopes of suggestions. I got three large planter boxes. The dimensions are 32 inches by 42 inches and 26 inches tall. They're in full sun, and I've recently planted the first. My plant selection has missed the mark in one regard. I failed to put something fragrant in it. A couple are fragrant if brushed, but not fragrant on the breeze. I'm hoping you can make some good suggestions. I'm generally happy with the color scheme, that they aren't super thirsty, that they stand up to the wind, they have a low height, they're successful in attracting hummingbird, and the long bloom period. So that's 6 out of 7 goals achieved. What? Please help me with a few ideas for something to add that would be fragrant on the breeze and no taller than 2.5 feet. We love sitting by these boxes, but aren't willing to add tall plants that would block our view. My husband suggested perhaps a dwarf gardenia.
Yeah, so this is Oakland, first of all, important to note, right? Oakland, correct? Yeah, so a lot cooler than here. Gardenia actually is a thought. Gardenias love warm conditions. We sell them here in the Davis area, and we tell people full morning sun, early afternoon sun is fine. Late afternoon sun is a little too much for gardenias sometimes in our climate, but boy, in Oakland they'd be fine in full sun, and they are fragrant. Now, there are several different varieties. The biggest one, Mystery, would get 5 feet or so. Vichii, VEITCHII, Vichii is probably the most commonly grown gardenia, at least it was for many years. A mature plant would be 3 feet, maybe 4 feet with equal spread, and they're very easily kept shorter than that. So that would perhaps be a normal-ish gardenia that would fit in there and could be kept the height you're after. There is a dwarf gardenia, usually sold with the name radicans, and it's a 1 foot grower, maybe 2 feet across, little 1 inch gardenia flowers that are particular, they're the same fragrance. All gardenias are white, all gardenias have the same fragrance. They just vary in how big the plants get. So you could look for the miniature one. Let me pull out my Western garden book here and tell you the exact name you should be looking for that variety under, because I've seen in the trade a couple different names put on it. Gardenia radicans is the most common name. There is a variegated form. The variegation is not stable. So you'll get variegated branches, and then they'll be all green on the next branch and so forth. So that's kind of an interesting characteristic. 6 to 12 inches tall, spreads to 2 to 3 feet. Very small, dark green leaves, inch wide summer flowers. In Oakland, it'll probably continue to set blooms all the way into the fall or even into the early winter. Our experience with gardenias, being from a much warmer climate than here, is they'll continue to initiate flower buds as long as it's warm and sunny. And those flower buds take a couple of weeks to open. And if it gets below about 50 at night, they'll fall off instead of opening. So in our area, gardenias are going to be finishing up their bloom season fairly soon. But in the Bay Area and in Southern California, they can continue blooming right on into the winter. It's not uncommon for those of you outside of the area for September into October to be very warm and sunny, particularly in Southern California. So you could continue to get gardenia blooms on there well into the fall, and a bloom that initiates as late as early November could even open into December. This is one of the reasons gardenias are such popular florist crop. You'll see them in Trader Joe's and places like that, just selling them as little flowering indoor plants. No, they're not good indoor plants, but they will continue to try and bloom under bright, warm conditions. And so greenhouses will have them available for you, even out of what I would call proper gardenia blooming season. But in Oakland, that would certainly be a good possibility. Now, in trying to look up ideas for you, I did find that my own business website, redwoodbarn.com, if you do a little Google search just for the word fragrant or fragrance, I've written a lot of articles on this subject. If you go to redwoodbarn.com, there's a little Google search box. It only searches within redwoodbarn.com and type in fragrant or fragrance or something like that. I pulled up articles from back in 25, 30 years ago on this topic. So you'll probably find some interesting ideas there. And if any of them catch your fancy, send us a follow-up note and we can certainly talk about them. There are many things that have fragrant foliage. That was something we talked about a couple weeks ago, a garden of fragrant foliage plants. Some of those, the fragrance does volatilize from the leaf and drift into the air. Some of the scented geraniums, for example, even if you're just nearby and you're not brushing them, you'll get the fragrance out of some of them. There are plants like the Mexican marigold, Tagetes limonii. Tagetes is the genus of marigolds. Limonii is a winter-blooming Mexican marigold with an extremely pungent fragrance to the foliage. If someone walks in carrying a 1 gallon of this from the nursery yard up to the counter and sets it on the counter, everyone in the downstairs of the nursery can smell it. It's a strong anise-like scent, actually very pleasant, but very, very pungent. And so this is one where just sitting nearby it, even without touching it, you'll often get some fragrance. Now, it used to be that Mexican marigold was a 3 to 4 foot plant. Now there's a dwarf version that only gets about 2 feet. You'll probably find that at any of a number of garden centers in the Bay Area and in the Sacramento Valley right now because they bloom in the fall and winter time. They have that bright orangey yellow marigold flower, and they have this amazing fragrance to the foliage. So while it is a foliage plant for fragrance, it disseminates that fragrance without you necessarily having to touch it. Just moving on the breeze will probably take care of it. I'll mention a couple of plants you could add to this, and Lois is going to grimace as I mentioned paper white narcissus. They're very
I'm
fragrant.
not too fond of their fragrance.
I
I
think
prefer
outdoors,
the freesias. They're much.
I think outdoors in a planter is a great place for paper white narcissus because you can leave them out there and then go inside when you're done with them. So they bloom anytime here, November through March, depending on the variety. Powerfully sweet and sort of musky smell. Some people find it overpowering, but outside is a great place where, yes, freesias were the one we were talking about before we went on the air. Hard to find. The bulbs have been in very short supply, but freesias have a wonderful fragrance all of their own. Lilies are generally too tall, but the Asiatic lilies could stay at least in the 3 foot range. Those would be for blooming next summer. So that's a sort of a different category. Bulbs you could plant for bloom. I'm a big fan of pinks, the whole dianthus group, and some of them are fragrant enough that you would probably get that a couple feet away, or at least you could reach over and pick a little miniature carnation and smell it with a wonderful spicy clove-like scent. So that's a possibility. Some of the scented thymes, the lemon-scented thyme, which is sold in the herb section at the garden center that you prefer to go to. It's got a golden variegated leaf. It's a very pretty little plant, and it has that strong citronella compounded. On a sunny day, that will volatilize from the leaf and drift away, and you're likely to get that as well. So those are some that I could think of that would stay short enough. And I'm going to throw in one of my favorite roses. I know this sounds odd because roses usually get big. You'll have to mail order this one. It's not going to be at your local garden center. The Persian musk rose. Rosa muscata nasturana is a 3 to 4 foot rose, semi-double flowers, very delicate white papery petals, and a wonderful honeysuckle scent only in the early evening. It's one of those roses where they open out and they cast their volatile compounds out to the atmosphere, trying to draw pollinators as we get close to dusk. And it's a very manageable rose. It only gets about 3 to 4 feet. Mine is maybe 5 feet at the end of the season, and doesn't even need pruning particularly, and moderately shade tolerant. So you're probably going to have to go to a mail order, as we used to call them, or internet companies to find that heirloom roses, antique rose emporium, some of the ones you'll find online, because garden centers are not going to have the Persian musk rose, but its fragrance drifts in the early evening, much like honeysuckle, which is another plant that would do what you're after, but of course is a vine, so it wouldn't necessarily fit in your current layout.
So Tara from Oakland asks, in a recent show, you mentioned the time to scatter California wildflower seeds is approaching. Beyond the delightful California poppy and the purple owl's clover, that's Castilleja exerta, which is already on my list, would you please discuss how some low-growing options for a gopher-infested steep hillside? Also, suggestions on where to source the seeds from. A place that might large sell larger quantities than the tiny packets would be appreciated.
Well, starting with the tiny packets, Theodore Payne Foundation is one of the best sources on those. They are out of Southern California, but for people who are just looking for samplers, that's a good place to start. Here in Davis, in Yolo County, I should say, there was is and was a company called Hedgerow Farms. Hedgerow Farms was founded by John Anderson locally 30 years ago plus, and they specialize in going out and gathering and tracking where they get them, native flower and perennial and grass seeds. And you, if you're, by the way, doing a major revegetation or something, you probably already know about Hedgerow Farms. You can find out exactly where the seed you're buying came from. You know, they literally have a map and they track all that kind of thing. Hedgerow Farms, after he passed away, became a part of a larger seed company, but they've kept it intact. And I'm going to get you the name of the company you would be ordering from, Native Seed Group. Native Seed Group. Dot com, nativeseedgroup.com, which absorbed Hedgerow Farms but has kept it intact as a separate entity. And there's all kinds of information in there about different wildflowers, different where they get them, and all that kind of thing. I think you could spend a lot of time looking at that. I believe they have like $100 minimum, something like that. They're not trying to sell packets to home gardeners, but if you do have a hillside and you could work with some neighbors, you could probably put together an order pretty readily. It's a fascinating organization. I highly recommend their approach, which is going, gathering, tracking, giving you the information so you know exactly what you're planting. Lupins come to mind as a good possibility, but you want to get the right kind of lupin for your hillside. I don't know if gophers eat lupins. They probably do. But I think if you got enough of them going, you could perhaps get ahead of the gopher-infested hillside problem and get them to establish. And once you get most of these things established under the right conditions, they'll multiply themselves. California poppies being a classic example. One plant produces 2,000 to 3,000 seeds. So it's getting that one plant established that is the start of the process. I have many conversations with people who say, I keep buying wildflower seed and throwing it out there, and I just don't see anything. I'm going, what is out there? What is there in the out there where you're throwing it? You throw poppy seeds, as we know, onto area that's got weeds and grass cover, the seed will just filter down in there and patiently wait 10, 20, 30 years if necessary, should be exposed to the sun and bare soil. So other seeds will come up quite readily. Some things like lupin really have to go through the full winter so that the seed coat softens. So pre-soaking the seed could be helpful on that one, or scarring the seed somehow. Any a number of things you can do, scarification or just pre-soaking them. So in those cases, you may actually be taking out little groups of seed, climbing up on the hillside and planting them by hand if necessary. But in the case of things like the poppies, as you know, if you just go out right before a rainstorm, tidy tips, the lupins would be things to add, flax, the red flowered scarlet flax. These are things that you could consider adding. You'll have to try to get rid of the debris, the grassy stuff that's presently on the slope. That's the key. The one thing that'll come up through the weeds is grasses. The other things we've talked about typically won't. So if you want a hillside of grasses, that's easy. If you want a hillside of flowers, that's more challenging. So you have to kind of pull away that stuff and then be planting the seed onto essentially bare soil, although you want it to settle into the soil a little bit so that the roots can quickly penetrate that soil when they start to germinate. It's a challenge to get them started. The hand watering becomes really necessary. The earlier you can do it, the better temperature wise, but the later you can do it, the better soil moisture wise. So those are your trade-offs. And buying extra seed is probably a good plan, and just continuing to go out there anytime a rainstorm is coming in and throw more seed out. That would be the first thing I would do, is just plan that when you see there's going to be half an inch to an inch of rain coming in, that's the time to run out there and throw some more seed on any bare soil areas. But I'll steer you towards Hedgerow Farms. And there, as I say, part of nature's seed dot nature, excuse me, nativeseedgroup.com. And you'll have other information there about how they do things and how to order from them.
If you go to redwoodbarn.com and you go to that little search field up there, now don't just go to Google and Google it. No. Go to his website and then use that search field because even though it's powered by Google, it will only search his website, which has hundreds and thousands of things on it. It's amazing. So look for cool season annuals. And what you'll come up with is an old chart. And I can tell you this is that table is really old. I can tell because I can see that it was made before we had all those prettifying things
Yeah.
that you could use
Yep.
for
Just
websites.
very, very basic.
But
Yep.
it has the season, the common name, the genus, the species, and then comments about it. So if you go in here and you go, Johnny Jump Up, what the heck is that? Viola tricolor. And in the notes, it says the easiest of the pansy family, often blooming well into spring. Well, that's something you could plant now.
Yeah, this actually is a chart of cool season annuals, and we tend to focus on vegetables here. So let's take a minute instead to talk about the cool season annuals. And what I mean by that, we sometimes call them winter annuals. Cool season is really more appropriate because they are from mid-fall to mid to late spring is their actual active growth cycle. Most of these are plants you can plant anytime from mid-September into, let's say, early December. And then frequently the same plants are put in for a quick season of bloom in February for bloom March or April. So it's not strictly winter annuals. Cool season is more appropriate. These are the plants that like temperatures between 50 and 80, 55 and 85 degrees. They're okay down into the 40s or even the 30s. They're not harmed by frost, so they can go down into very cold weather in our area, USDA Zone 9. If you're in anything colder than USDA Zone 9, some of these may not be appropriate for you. But we're in a great place here because we can grow a lot of these things September, October, all the way into April or May. We call them annuals, but a lot of them are or would be perennials, like pansies, violas would be perennials, except that we get so hot by May to June that the plants look really bad, even if they aren't killed by the heat. And most people just take them out at that point. So while they're functionally could be perennials, we grow them as annuals. In fact, when I was first getting into gardening, I used to look at the W. Attlee Burpee Seed Company, my father's favorite seed catalog. And I learned a phrase in there that I found incredibly useful at the other end of the season, tender perennial grown as an annual. Many of the things we call annuals, petunias, Madagascar periwinkle, the Vinca rosea, are actually perennials, but they're cold tender. Well, this is the opposite side of that. These are cool season perennials grown as annuals because they would be killed by temperatures or so badly affected by temperatures above about 90 degrees that most people take them out. Some of them do come back. Some of them you can leave in through the summer. You can get them through the summer and get 3, 4 years out of them. Snapdragons are a good example. So when I talk about annuals, some of you may be listening in places where these are longer lived plants and are actually functioning as perennials. But the very first one on here, well, the second one on here is calendula.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Not, and my comment, not a refined flower, but
No.
reliable.
And it reseeds freely.
Yes.
Once you plant calendulas, there's no problem with
Yeah.
having more next year and
Yeah.
next year and next year.
That six pack or that pack of seeds you get is basically a starter kit, and they will be back. There's a lot of new breeds of calendulas with just a different color range. Basically, calendulas look like marigolds, except they bloom in the wintertime. They're orange, yellow, almost red, dark burgundy brown colors, really cool colors on them. And I've had them blooming through the summer. I mean, well, I tell you, this is a cool season annual. If it's not super hot and they're in maybe light shade, they can continue into the summer. And the seedlings will certainly get through the summer for the next year. Next on the list is California poppy. Of course, we plant that seed in the late summer, fall, early winter. Blooms starting midwinter into early summer. Yes, they are perennial. In fact, I learned something from a guy who used to run the Arboretum years ago that if you cut them back in late spring, going into early summer, and get rid of all that fleshy foliage, the plant has a higher likelihood of making it through the summer without rotting and will pop back up in late summer, early fall, and start blooming as early as September and continue to bloom for 2 or 3 years. So, California poppies, short-lived perennials, usually grown as a cool season annual. There's a couple on this list that I was reviewing as we started putting together our calendar, our Redwood Barn calendar for sale. And the person who does it for me, we're looking at some of the lists and going, wow, primrose? When was the last time we sold primroses? There are some things on this list that have definitely fallen out of the nursery trade almost completely. Primroses were a big deal for nurseries in the 80s and 90s. And then the botrytis mold and the amount of spraying they needed, fungicides in the commercial production. And the fact that they take 4 to 6 months to get to a saleable product compared to 2 to 3 months in the case of some of the other things, they just completely fell out of the trade. But they are beautiful, amazing, cool season annuals, perennials that we grow as annuals, particularly the English primrose. That one actually has some fragrance. When a flat of primroses comes in, if you happen to be at a nursery that still sells them, some of them are fragrant, some of them are not. So look for that. For someone who's looking for fragrant flowers for a container, old-fashioned English primroses, some of them do have fragrance. Fairy primrose, I don't think I've seen that on a list in more than
I
20
miss
years.
those.
Yeah,
They were
those are great.
so
They
nice.
were cute little plants, but just fell out of the trade completely. By comparison, Iceland poppies, which we plant anytime in November, December, all the way into February, that's a poppy that does very well here and blooms in the winter and into the spring. So Iceland poppies, in our climate and pretty much everywhere I'm aware of, functions as an annual, even though it hypothetically could be perennial, not heat tolerant, but blooms right through the middle of the winter. You mentioned Johnny Jump Up. That's just a type of viola. That's just a particular species in the genus Viola, which includes pansies, are a type of viola, what we call violas, which are just smaller flowered variants, basically, of pansies, and many of the hybrids between them. Those are our classic winter cool season annuals here. Violas hold up in the weather better than pansies do. Violas hold their flowers up, and even when it's raining, they're still standing upright.
Pansies face plant.
Yes, they face right into the mud.
Yep.
And part of that is the breeding of pansies for many years with the Swiss giants, the Rogley hybrids, and the others was for bigger and bigger and bigger flowers. There are some of the Rogley hybrids and the Swiss giants that are 4-inch blooms. I mean, amazing blooms. But if there's even a drizzle, they just fall face down into the mud. They were actually developed for a greenhouse trade. Unheated greenhouses in the UK, they would grow pansies. They have long stems, they have big flowers. There actually was a market for that. Home gardeners, I grow those. I like them. I put them where they're sheltered from the wind and the rain because they really have to be in our climate. Otherwise, they're just basically face down in the mud all the time. But there are newer hybrids between pansies and violas, okay? And there are violas that are getting bigger flowered, more like pansies. So it's becoming a spectrum rather than a binary choice between pansies and violas. Look for the ones holding themselves up. Look for violas in general, and you'll just get more for your garden from that. But violas, you can put them right out in the garden. You can put them in a planter that gets rained on, and they'll hold their heads up and look lovely. So violas are very easy to grow and less prone to botrytis mold, the mold that makes the flowers rot basically than the pansies are because they just don't have such thick, fleshy flower petals.
I think the one on this list that I would encourage people to try if they haven't recently is stock. It has such a sweet fragrance, but it's not overpowering. They're beautiful.
Yeah, they are. And they're easy to grow. They're hard to find. They're not real common in nurseries. So there aren't like a zillion varieties as there are with snapdragons and pansies and such. It's best to get them in early. September to early October is great for stock if you can find them, because then they'll flush from the base and give you several spikes of bloom per plant. If you buy them later, each plant will produce one spike of blooms initially, but don't give up. Cut that back, deadhead it when it's done, and then it will flush from the base and give you another bloom February to March. And stock is notable for its fragrance. And if you're into cut flowers, you happen to grow things more for arrangements, go online and find the stock that's been developed, Harris Seed, Johnny Seed, some of these well-known companies that sell to truck farmers and small-scale farmers. There are some that are grown for cutting, very long stems for cutting. Those are great. And they've got a nice, pleasant fragrance that isn't overpowering. And then in the big category to me in the winter that everybody should be growing more are the snapdragons because the newer day neutral snapdragons come in and bloom. They'll continue to bloom through the winter and give a heavy bloom in the late winter and spring. Old fashioned snapdragons are worth growing if you have the room for it, but they typically don't give a lot of bloom until next spring. You plant them now, pinch them back, let them flush from the base, and you'll get an amazing bloom on them late March into mid-May in our climate. So that's that group. It fell out of favor because of the new what we call day neutral types that start blooming right in the container. Obviously, great for retailers. But I try all these just to make sure that they will do something good for you. And they do keep blooming, even without deadheading. They keep blooming right on through the winter and spring. So, snapdragons, if you haven't grown them in a while, you definitely should consider some of those. And my experience has been if I just cut them back in May when we first start to get hot, rather than pulling them out, They'll flush out. They'll stay there through the summer. They might even try and bloom a little bit, but then they come back into bloom. I'm looking out the window right now and I see some already sending up bloom spikes for this winter that I planted a year ago. They gave me bloom in the spring. I cut them back, shoved them off to the side where they got watered more or less automatically. And now they're coming back to start up their winter bloom again. So snapdragons give a lot of bloom, for the buck.
If you have access to a Sunset Western Garden book, look in there and look for annuals for season color. They have information and they have pictures for some of them.
Yeah, a
So.
couple that are on that chart actually that I'll mention that are not on mine because they're handled a little differently. African daisy. This the African daisies, osteospermums. There's a bunch of new forms that are more shrub-like than the ground cover type you might be familiar with. They bloom in the wintertime. Gazanias bloom in the wintertime. Interestingly, a lot of people buying and planting gazanias as annuals. Gazanias are perennial. The clump forms last 3 years or so. Ground cover forms are more or less permanent. But when the bedding plant industry discovers a plant that blooms a lot in a container, they'll just market it as an annual. And there are also places in the country where it's not perennial, or it dies when we get into hot weather or in the winter, depending on where you're listening. So gazanias are now being sold as annuals. Here they are perennial, but they're primarily winter blooming as early as October, as late as May, but primarily midwinter bloom. They also mentioned one that I forgot to even mention, one of my favorite plant groups, Dianthus, the pinks, which bloom, various varieties bloom basically all the time, particularly the cottage pinks, the little ones you buy as annuals, which are actually short-lived perennials. They also mentioned one native wildflower, Clarkias and Godetias, which are two different plants but closely related. There are garden hybrids of these, but they're actually California wildflowers. They're planted in the fall, they grow through the winter, they bloom in the spring, and of course, the common name is farewell to spring. So they're one of the last of the spring-blooming annual wildflowers. And the one group that we haven't even touched on is sweet peas. I kind of wondered why sweet peas had fallen out of favor because they were. If you look at seed catalogs from 100 years ago, which I do periodically, you will find amazing number of varieties of sweet peas. And then, as a retailer, I can tell you they've never been a real seller for us, and people don't even really grow them all that much. Here in the valley, partly that is that they're sensitive to extreme heat, so they're strictly a winter and spring bloom. But the amount of bloom you get is amazing. However, having grown them, grown a bunch of different types, I kind of see the problem. They do need support. They need something to scramble onto. If you just stick sweet peas in the ground, now you have a sweet pea ground cover, and that doesn't work so well. It can just be as little as 3 to 4 feet. They'll get taller than that, but they'll be fine. They'll sort of sprawl over the top. 5 to 6 feet would probably be better for most types. They give a lot of bloom, and I discovered when I took flowers into my nursery, some people really don't like the fragrance. Many people love the fragrance. Most people really like the fragrance. But when I walked in with a bouquet of sweet peas at one point and set it on the counter, one staff person, "Oh my God, I hate those." And they had to go outside. So you do encounter that. They are pungently, sweetly, slightly muskily fragrant. There are short types. Knee-high is one example. It only goes to about 3 feet. The other thing about them, one, they scatter their seeds freely at the end of the season. So once you plant sweet peas, the seedlings do tend to come up. Not as bad as morning glory, but the same kind of thing. You're a little surprised how many of them are coming up here and there after you've had them. And the end of the season thing, I do think that part of the reason people stop growing certain things is what they look like when they're done. And sweet peas are a big viney thing that you then have to pull down and clean up. And so maybe that's part of why people don't have positive feelings about them. But sweet peas do grow quite readily here in USDA Zone 9 and of course in USDA Zone 10. In USDA Zone 8 or lower, you probably don't start them until spring. But here we do them in the fall and midwinter, and we get midwinter to spring bloom all the way into about May. Sweet peas are worth it at least once so you can see the amazing array of colors and enjoy the fragrance of them, but be aware that some people find them a little overpowering.
So we've been talking about the cool season annuals, and I've been talking about the table, which is on Don's website. And it turns out, underneath the cool season annuals, there's the warm season annuals. So you with one chart, you can get both cool and warm. But it is not got bulbs on it. So if you want plant bulbs, well, look for another thing. Just go and search that little search engine box up there for bulbs, and boy, will you find all sorts of
Oh yeah,
things.
I have written lots of articles about bulbs over the years because I am fascinated by them. They've always been a big category for us. I have to say the bulb sales in retail nursery industry have are a fraction of what they used to be. We probably sell 10 to 20% of the total number of bulbs we used to sell 30 years ago. The people planting bulbs in the fall for spring bloom has just completely disappeared. But they are there. Nurseries still bring them in. We pot a lot of them because a lot of them don't sell in bulb form. But it is a good time to start looking for bulbs. Some of ours have come in. We have our saffron crocus right now, for example. Ranunculus came in. We potted them right away. The amaryllis, I don't know why my bulb supplier sent those now, but we have the amaryllis for the holidays, and the tulips and the daffodils and all that kind of stuff are also coming in. One quick note on that, since we get the common question about those kinds of bulbs, they're told that they need to put them in the refrigerator for 4 to 6 weeks before planting. That is not true here. You don't need to do that. We don't plant tulips, hyacinths, or giant flowered crocus, three rather important categories there, tulips, true hyacinths, and the giant flowered crocus until the soil has cooled off. We put them in November. It's fine in December. It's actually fine as late as January. So you wait till the soil has cooled for those three types. Daffodils, narcissus, freesias, if you can find them, grape hyacinths, wood hyacinths, many of the other what we call minor bulbs in the industry. If they're at the nursery or the hardware store, you can buy them and plant them right now, no problem. But there's no hurry. We plant bulbs all the way into January. And of course, keep in mind, these are in general perennial plants that in some cases will multiply very freely and become a big part of your landscape for decades. I have bulbs here on my farm that we planted in the 1980s that have increased significantly. Particularly paper whites are one example, but a lot of other types of daffodils, some of the others have increased quite a bit. So keep that in mind when you plant them. That probably is a fairly permanent decision. I mentioned saffron crocus. That one's unusual. Some years I get it, some years I don't. Saffron crocus, which is a true crocus, Crocus sativus, is fall planted, blooms in the fall. You plant it now, it blooms in November, mid to late November, and you harvest the little red thing in the middle there. You quickly realize why saffron is so expensive because the part you're picking is just one part of the flower and you have to pick it at ground level. So imagine a whole field of that being harvested. The fragrance is stunning. If you like saffron rice or paella or recipes like that, it's an essential part of those types of recipes and very easy to grow in the Central Valley. It loves a sunny location. It likes to be dry in the summer. My best plantings have generally been in areas that are unirrigated in the summertime. It's okay with some irrigation, but it's also fine in a low water landscape. It's a Mediterranean bulb and it's tolerant of xeric conditions, so it can go into almost any landscape setting as long as it gets enough sun. But it's fall planted, fall blooming, and that's a little confusing to some people. Here at KDRT, we want to thank you many times over for your generous support of KDRT's 21st birthday fundraiser. Your support keeps us going and growing strong with the shows you love and new programs to explore. If you haven't had the chance to give yet, there's still time. Just visit kdrt.org/donate. And mentioning there, new shows, there's a new one that just started in early September called Dashboard Diaries. You can hop in for a trip through ever-changing musical landscapes, from familiar highways to roads less traveled. Dashboard Diaries host Ray Kay loves to share hand-picked tunes spanning broad styles of music with a nod to the real, organic, disc jockey-driven radio of his youth. It's all about the journey. That's Dashboard Diaries, live Thursdays, 3 to 4 p.m.
Well, at the end of the show, I like to give you a garden quote. You know that old saying, nature abhors a vacuum?
Yes.
Well, it doesn't much like a leaf blower either.
Even listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.